Hello, and welcome to What is Innovation? The podcast that explores the reality of a word that is in danger of losing its meaning altogether. This podcast is produced by Outlast Consulting, LLC, a boutique consultancy that helps companies use innovation principles to solve their toughest business problems. I'm your host, Jared Simmons, and I'm so excited to have Colin Hunter. Colin Hunter is an author, mentor, coach, and CEO of Potential Squared, an international business that specializes in creating playgrounds to disrupt the way people are led. Three areas of focus include building leadership capabilities, strengthening functional capability, and guiding innovative cultures. Colin generates a lasting professional impact with those he works with and is renowned for being what they and he calls refreshingly direct, lighting inspirational fires to drive change. He facilitates, mentors, and coaches individuals and teams in the areas of leadership presence, personal brand, change leadership, innovation, strategic dialogue, creating board-level influence, and earning a seat at the executive table. With the use of actors, cutting-edge virtual realities, and a new leadership framework, clients have shown award-winning difference in the ways they lead. Colin prides himself by practicing what he preaches with being wrong more and learning fast from it. Colin, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jared. Good to be here. I need to cut down that intro for you in the future because it's sounding like I just do a whole long list of things. I need to be more focused. Well, nice to be here, sir.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. It's tough when you got that many talents, man.
Probably a lot of people listening, Jared, who are going, yeah, what is his talent? Come on. What is it?
Well, we'll dive right in then, so we can get into it. What is innovation?
That's a tough question because it's almost in the title about, you know, is that word going to disappear? So we've put a different spin on it, and we've put it into the concept of playgrounds. So for me, innovation is about creating a playground, putting the user at the center, the human user at the center, and then it's about experimentation, observation, and learning with the user in mind. So we've taken it to almost sometimes described as the fifth level of innovation, where you're innovating with your clients in that space and working. So it's not about paint by numbers, as some people describe. For me, it's about the really fresh ideas, but the live fresh ideas that come through working with the real problems. So that's my passion. It's about diving into the fresh problems with your customer in that space. So that to me is innovation. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So many things there I want to unpack. The real problem, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about what playgrounds mean. Oh, and also the human user. I want to unpack that as well. But tell me what you mean by the real problem. What do you see in that space?
The real problem is a couple of things in here, because the first answer, and it's a bit when we're doing coaching as well, the first answer you give, so what's on your mind? The first answer we normally give is, well, it's this client or this problem that we've got. But actually, once you get the and what else, which is Michael Bungay Stanier's coaching habit question, which I love, the or question, and what else?
Yes.
By the time you get the fifth or sixth, then you get to the real issue that's on your mind. And it's the same with ideas. You know, when you get to the ideas thing, the novel detail is brilliant. TED Talk and novel detail, you know, tigers are great at, bears are great at, have you ever seen the TED Talk? Brilliant. But it's about the 12th or 13th idea. And it's the real issue tends to not be the first issue that customers come up with. It is once you've gone in there and you've exposed and you've started to identify and observe people in that reality, the real issue comes up. So if I just, you know, for those who can remember, a quick story in that there's an old neighbor of mine had a car, and she had a gas consumption problem on the car. And she took it into the garage 5-6 times. And each time they tried, tested and said, no, there's nothing wrong with your car. The fuel consumption is great. Gas consumption is great.
Right.
So eventually one of the mechanics said, I'll tell you what, Miss Brown, why don't you drive for me? Why don't I get in and you take me for a drive? And so Miss Brown got into the seat. Nudley later, about 75, she got into the seat. She sat down and she pulled out the manual choke, for those who remember them, that comes out of the dashboard, which helps you to start the car,
right,
and hung her handbag on the manual Now, you know, the real problem was that the car didn't have somewhere to hang her handbag on. Yeah. But the assumption was that, you know, she was driving it wrong. She was doing something wrong. So, you know, if you take that into business, there's so many times people say, you know, it's the problem is my salespeople. There's problems. It's actually once you get into the real problem and you observe and you gain insight, those are not the real problems. Now, it might take you a while to get there, but right. But that's what, you know, innovation is about, is having the patience to see what the real problem is.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a very entertaining anecdote to illustrate that point. And I love anecdotes like that, because this is really something that's very close to the heart of people. People who've had tried to guide folks through this part of innovation, you know how hard it is to get someone to let go of that first problem.
Yeah.
To even get to the consideration that that is not the problem.
Yeah.
And so I love that you've got that sort of light analogy to talk about it, because it's the heavy lifting. It's the, you know, the grunt work of the innovation work is being with someone as they walk that journey of, mm-hmm. okay, well, yeah, sales are down, but it might not be mm-hmm. the sales team that's at fault here.
Yeah.
Just getting that ounce of doubt slid in between the client and that first problem is a huge challenge. I'm sure you've dealt with it more than your fair share of times, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Patience is part of it as well.
Yes.
Particularly when you're on the clock as a consultant or as a coach and people have got budgets. Yeah. Or even if they've got time, then, you know, that curiosity, go, okay, we'll go for this one because this seems to be the likely problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's all things. So I give you $1 million. How much are you willing to bet of that $1 million that this is the real problem? And then you see them go 60%. Okay, so I don't think we're ready yet. Let's spend a bit more time and go into the, you know, it can take us 2 months to define the how might we statement, as we call it, with clients, let alone do anything else. So yeah, powerful bit.
Ah, that's the unsung portion of the work. Mm. And if you skip over that and dive right into, you know, let's get a bunch of people into a room for 3 days and some post-its and whiteboards and all that stuff. Mm. That's the sexy part that everybody talks about, but it's that first couple months of wrestling with the perception and reality and opening the mind a bit. Mm. That's the hard work of this work.
It is.
You talked about the human user.
Mm.
You made a distinction there. Tell me more about that distinction. Why add the word human to that?
I'm a great believer in dispelling myths. And, you know, I have these things created in my head. So I have this, you know, thought that Amazon is going to automate everything. And that when you go to an Amazon, you know, office or warehouse, then everything is automated. So there's nobody in there. And there's people in yellow jackets checking the robots to understand it. And I was having a very large breakfast with a friend on Sunday, and they were telling me about Amazon. And you know, I was so surprised that there's so many humans involved in Amazon, but that's my lack of understanding. Mm. And the fundamentals, when you come down to this, is the human, the person has a future in innovation, has a future in organization, but has massive future as a customer. And therefore, putting the human at the center of whatever you do is an important bit. And I link it to purpose, because when you think about purpose, you know, Man's Search for Meaning, other books I'm reading at the moment, you know, around peak performance. Mm-hmm. They always talk about, if you do it for yourself, it doesn't work. But if you do stuff for other people and have other people involved in that, then the human becomes your focus. Oh. It drives behavior. In other words, you know, why would I be more wrong, which is, you know, what I talk about? Why would I be more wrong for no purpose?
Right.
And the purpose has got to involve people. So I'm failing in the path of a direction towards something is an important part.
Mm.
But I'm a strong believer that humans will influence everything, purchasing, you know, even just if I go to my experience of buying myself any products, then I would click on, I get irritated by, you know, being felt like I'm being conned or being taken for a ride. I get irritated by service. I do a lot of work in the luxury service area.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go and you pay a fortune in a luxury hotel, pay $10,000 a night for a suite.
Oh my God.
And they give you cookie cutter service. You're like, well, hold on a second. I'm paying this amount and I'm getting this. So we, you know, specialize in terms of helping leaders to think, so what is the art of the possible? And putting the human at that. So another little story just to bring to life. So we were doing mystery shopping for Claridge's in London, and a brilliant client. And we took my daughters along. And my daughters were with us, so nobody knew we were coming in. We were checking in, and we were too early to check in. So they said, okay, we'll store your bags. And we'd been shopping. And we'd bought for the girls, Melman and Gloria out of Madagascar, if you know the characters. Melman and Gloria out of Madagascar. Yeah. So they had the stuffed toys. So we left Melman and Gloria with the Claridge's staff and went off. And we came back later on. So at check-in, they took us up to the room to check us in. And as we got towards our room, the lady who was leading us there went, shh, put her finger to her mouth and whispered, shh, to the girls who are young, right. You know, 7 or 8 years old. Yeah. Said, okay, be quiet. So we got to the door and she opened the door and the whole room was in darkness. And she said, shh, they've gone to sleep. And I was in the background going, this is amazing, but who's gone to sleep in our room?
Yeah.
That was my adult side, but their kids were mesmerized by this, the girls. And then they went through to the bedroom. And what they'd done was they'd done turn down service, but they'd created a mini bed for Melman and Gloria, and they tucked them in at the bottom of the bed.
No way.
So they put the toys to bed. So our girls just thought, every time you go to a hotel, this is what happens. They put your toys to bed. They create magic. Now, for me, if that isn't putting the human at the center of an amazing experience that my princesses will talk about, well, Dad, you know, we're going to a hotel that there's no service. You don't get taken to the room and our toys are not put to bed. That's a human experience that you can be magnified into something special.
Unbelievable. That is brilliant. Such a great example. And probably some extra sheets from the linen closet.
Yeah.
A little folding, 5 extra minutes in the turndown service. And it's a childhood memory.
It is.
Unbelievable. Great, great story. Yeah. Great story. Unfortunately, they're probably in for some disappointment.
The caravan in Scotland that we go to at the moment isn't quite cutting it at the moment.
I can imagine. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That is great. Yeah. So that's a great sort of, you know, from that childhood memory into playgrounds, which was the other piece I wanted to talk about from your definition of innovation. So tell me about playgrounds.
Well, it's an interesting concept because when we first put it in, I was writing the book and I was getting this concept in my mind. The playgrounds, we realized that the playground sometimes has a negative connotation. For some people, the playground was the time they were bullied. But the playground, if we take the wider connotation, is the time where you're going to play and you're going to have fun and you release. And whether it's going for a run in the mountains, you know, whether it's going to the Rockies and camping, or whether it's for some people, it's, you know, doing an adventure, going out in the seas, whether it's windsurfing, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, and even in businesses, I have an ex-colleague whose idea of fun and playground was going and doing the night shift at a retail store and seeing how it operated to get an understanding. But that was his passion, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So when we think about falling out of our thinking, we think about having fun and we think about being ourselves. Playgrounds tend to be where we let our hair down. We have a way of stretching ourselves. And even, you know, if I was the second last person picked for a team of sport at the playground, there was still that energy and that have a go and that experience, or whether it was your friends chatting and talking in the school. So we wanted to get this concept, and we'd worked with actors for many years, and in the spirit of giving people a playground to play with conversations. So we'd picked up on Whose Line Is It Anyway, the comedy show where the comedians interact improv with the audience.
Right.
And we took that for a stage further and said, okay, so why don't we create a space where we get two actors up front and we give them a scene to run through, and then we get the audience to have a remote control and play with that.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they could play with the conversation. So whether it's, you know, a conversation to deal with a tough client, or a conversation to deal with for an internal auditor dealing with their auditee who's done something wrong, who's trying to cover up something, then we craft that playground. So, you know, it might be 10, 15 people in that space who have 10 or 15 ideas how to have different conversations.
Yeah.
So why not give them the chance to go almost tag team and go, okay, you know, Frank, you go up and have a go first. Frank has a go and, you know, fails miserably, and goes, I don't know. And Loretta in the corner goes, you know, I've got a better idea. I'm going to try this. Or somebody comes in and goes, you're being too tough. Why don't we try a bit softer approach? So that concept of immersion, where the scene is real, where you're playing, where you're falling out your thinking, where it's almost as a group, you're starting to play with different concepts or different types of conversations. Mm. There's no right or wrong answer, but it's that spirit of somebody who says, you know, what we describe as a slap with a wet fish. Their view of the conversation should be a slap with a wet fish. If we slap them hard enough with a wet fish, they'll get it.
Right.
They have a go. And our actors are trained to, when they get a slap with a wet fish, the slap comes back with another big wet fish, and right. then it escalates.
Right.
We talk about the subtleties. So there's a playground where people can feel safe. So I've got, imagine if, you know, all our conversations that we have problems in the world at the moment, and we had the chance to go into a room and just play with those conversations.
I love that concept. And I think that the playground analogy sounds out of place initially, if you just describe the scene and what's going on. But the concept, the, like you said, the ethos around what it means to play and to be on the playground and to have that freedom and the, you know, the consequences of what I do are not permanent.
Yeah.
And I think that that sense of play and freedom and space without the rigidity of responsibility and structure in the traditional sense, I can see how that really creates a playground-like atmosphere as you're doing something as difficult as unpacking human interaction and dynamics. There's nothing more complex than having more than one person do something at the same time. So that, I love that idea of playgrounds and the space, just as you described the approach, the physical and psychological distancing of having actors kind of play it out and let people sort of witness that. I would imagine that would be a big part of what makes the magic of that process.
It is. And what's interesting, though, is that because the character, the actors are so good, then, I mean, we did this sort of interaction with the actors for looking at Heathrow and customer service, and we were getting actors to play head of customer service for Kenyan Airways, for example.
Right.
And the actors are so good that actually one of the actors was offered a job by British Airways, so not British Airways, Heathrow, to go and do this role, mainly because they were so good.
Wow.
But the actors make it so good that people don't remember the actor's name. They remember the character name.
Wow.
And they remember how that character made them feel. So, you know, you'll see them go into a room, do that, and then at lunch, they'll see their character, the actor, wandering around, and they'll go, nah, you were tough on me today, but I loved it. I loved it. But because they've had play and they've released.
Right.
So I think there's a reality to it that you've got to get into there, but there's a play. If I can give you another example that's really powerful for me, it's one of the things I would always encourage people who are running businesses to do. As I was advised to get an advisory board for my business. So I'd struggled with my business and you know, I'd gone through a number of business partners. And then somebody said, look, it's Experience Point. James Chisholm at Experience Point, great Canadian organization. He said, you know, you should get an advisory board. And he gave me a bit of advice. So rather than going to get advisors who had already been advisors for somebody else, we said, okay, so how could we create a playground to create an advisory board with people who had never been advisors before?
Interesting.
Now, in the UK, we call them non-exec directors.
Okay.
That's a goal for senior people to get to the point where they sit on a corporate board, Barclays or whatever else, and they have some legal accountability. But they're sat there and they're reading board papers and they're advising and they have a governance responsibility on the business.
Right.
But to get to that stage, where do they play? Where do they practice?
Mm.
So we're thinking, right, we could identify three people to come in who have never done this role before, but they're gonna play with us at developing it. And the other thing that's great for me, and this is goes about the innovation piece, is leave your ego and expertise at the door, is we don't know what the right version of advisory board work is in the future. And maybe we're missing a real trick. So why not give them the opportunity to craft the role for us and us to play and see what it is? And it's amazing. We talk about two types. There's noses in, fingers in, where the nose is in the business and they can play with their fingers and they can do stuff, or noses and fingers out. So we played with the concept of noses and fingers out to start with and worked it. But that was a test. Now there's a few fingers coming in every so often. So there might be a bit of a hybrid role that we're working on, but we've been working on that, I think it's about 2 to 3 years now. So in theory, a lot of the stuff they're doing might have been invented before, but the way they're doing it about growing whilst doing a role that is, you know, affecting people's lives, roles, jobs, money,
Right.
Is a powerful piece, and it's a great way of putting the human at the center of the experiments of the issue.
Yeah.
What's the real issue? Why do advisors fail or succeed in the future and play with it? So that's another example.
Brilliant. That is a great example. I really like how you took something that is normally extremely parochial and extremely, it's something that you don't experiment with. You can do all these crazy things with your business in this sandbox over here, but then you need to go get an advisory board, and it needs to look like this and have this many people, and they need to do these things.
Yeah. And they've got to be this old.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's amazing how tactical the advice you get for that specific part of running a business. Nowhere else does someone say, yeah, you need a person with this background, that background, this background, that background. And yeah age, experience, all that stuff is such a narrow box. And so I just love that you just completely obliterated that box and use your own approach to fit for purpose solution.
If I ever go to court though, Jared, I'm not sure I'm going to play around with that. You know,
no.
If I'm ever, you know, or I'm under the knife and I said, but again, you know. How do surgeons learn how to be great surgeons? And the Risky Business is a conference that does this. It talks about how we psychologically safety, we can get people to make it, experiment, have a go at things and learn. But there you go. You're talking people's lives. How do they do that? So I'm joking there, but there's a truth to that.
Yeah.
How do we get our good surgeons? We've got to allow them to practice. Yeah.
Yes. We talked with a brilliant surgeon. I want to say episode 14. Dr. Maria Lucia Madariaga, she does transplants, and just the joy in her voice talking about what she does. And she plays music while she's in the operating room. And her goal is to make sure that everybody is excited about the healing that is about to take place in the room.
Yeah.
And just that mindset of, she probably wouldn't call it play, but a freedom and of kind of joy in what she does. And all I could see and think about while she was talking about this was the terror and the stress I would be feeling. And she expands in the moment. And I think in a moment where someone's life is hanging in the balance, I think I would contract.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, this element of, as you're talking about the playground, I think there's this element of that probably that exists for people in every domain. I can imagine there's an analog for that in every domain for the right person.
Absolutely. And how we get leaders to understand how to create it. But wouldn't it be great if you turned up to work and said, we're going to play today?
Yeah.
But you know, everybody go, yeah. But right. You know, I'll give you a preview of my next book is How to Create Playgrounds. I just want to go and just explore different organizations and say, so what are you doing to create playgrounds? What's working? Mm. You know, in my day, it was having a basketball hoop in the office was play table tennis.
Right. Putting greens.
And there's nothing more annoying than trying to do a conference call in an office with somebody playing ping pong in the background. I'm thinking, well, that might be your playground, but it's my work. You know, how do you, I want to do some experiments about what works and what the options are to do playgrounds. But that's a classic space for innovation.
Yeah. If I'm a business owner and I had an office of 20, 25 people and then COVID hit and everybody went home and only 12 of those people came back to the office.
Yep.
And another 12 are in London or they're in Aberdeen or they're wherever they are. How do I think about playgrounds in that environment?
I love that because I've just been writing a proposal for a client today just on that fact. And if you look back, you know, 12 to 18 months ago, and we were standing at a carousel in Phoenix, Arizona, just about to go to conference, and it was declared a global pandemic.
Oh my God.
We were face to face as a business. So all our work was face to face. And I'd always been one of these people saying, our work will never be done virtually. Yeah. And then suddenly it was like, okay, we're going to do this now. And I think the key thing for me is to create a playground. A lot of the work that happens is leaders go away and they say, okay, we've got a problem. I'm going to go away. So carry on as if we're here and we'll solve the problem for you and come back. Yeah. If you think about what's happened over the last 12 to 18 months is that we've got a view into different people's lives, worlds through the virtual.
Right.
We've got a view into that productivity can be increased through virtual work. Yeah. We've also got an insight into the pain points of, you know, young families who have to work at home with kids and everything else. So we've got insights into pain points and successes all the way through. But we've also got a new contract that we need to be talking with people about how we engage. And if we've had increased productivity, I mean, Accenture is one of our clients and they paid a bonus to their staff because their performance has gone through the roof through COVID.
Right, right.
But there's few people I know in there who've really suffered through it because of the work-life balance or life balance. So I'm a great believer that the playground, and this is where design thinking gets, maybe it's not a playground, but maybe it's a way of sailing the ship out of the harbor and saying we're going to head to rougher seas as a leader, which is the other concept I have in my mind, which is we don't want to go back to where we are. Yeah. Uh-huh. We want to go to a new place. But could that new place be a bit of the good stuff of here that we've learned over the 12 to 18 months? The good stuff. I mean, I'm a big hugger. I miss hugs.
Yeah.
So I want human contact.
Yeah.
The first time I met my CEO for 6 months, and that was the longest hug. Yeah, to do that.
Yeah.
So we want that connection, but we want to also just learn from everybody else who might not be a hugger. Yeah, who wants something different, and they've actually valued the fact that I'm on the other side of the screen and not hugging them when I'm meeting them. So how do we bring all of that together? But the key thing is, unless we involve our people in redefining and innovating.
Sure.
To craft it, then they're only renting that role. They're not owning it.
Mm.
And if you think about a rental house, and a friend in Australia gave me this, and he's probably going to want royalties because I keep using it. But, he talks about, you think about when you're renting a house, you don't take care of it. Yeah. You'll always ask the landlord to do the repairs. You've got permission. And it's sort of, I'm waiting for my next rental.
Mm.
If you own a house, you start to look after it. You're worried about the paint, the decor, the maintenance of it. And that, therefore, it's about saying, so you now own your roles. Come with us on this journey. How do we craft to be an inclusive piece? And not just for any tick box exercise. The real inclusion is, how do we make this a welcoming, caring, innovative, human-centric organization that's going to be a place where we want to thrive? It might be the launch of my career to go off into different areas or be successful. So that for me is where we are with playgrounds. So think about, break down five things. Think about a pulse in the morning, 9:15 to 9:45 is our pulse, our get together as a team in the morning. When it's hybrid, does the room dominate? So we've got virtual reality as a business. So I know that Accenture are starting to experiment where every leader, whether they're in the office or at home, will put on a virtual reality headset and they will go into a virtual reality room with whiteboards to do that check-in.
Everybody's on the same playing field. Even if you're in the room, you're in this virtual environment. That is fascinating.
So how would you play with that? So it's out of the box, literally.
Yeah.
The box of headsets on.
Yeah.
And the person was talking to me about that. She said she went in, bought headsets, and her son was in his room, young son, in the room, and he was lying in his bed in his headset. She said, what are you doing in the VR headset? He said, oh, I'm watching Netflix. She said, watching Netflix and headset. I said, not only doing that, but I've got a log fire on and I'm sat with a view out of Canada, out of a log cabin. Yeah. So I'm watching Netflix in a completely different environment. Now, that is great for me, but I would never have thought about it. I would say, well, okay, I'm going to trip over something. So rethinking, experimenting, creating a playground and thinking about, okay, today, so we're going to be in Canada for our meetup, but it's virtual. Level the playing field.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. That's fantastic. I wonder if it's just the nature of, your experience and your background and your way of thinking that gives you that sort of immediate positive sort of reframing around this challenge and the opportunities. But I do think that is critical to moving forward.
Mm.
But you immediately went to the kind of opportunities and the way forward. And I think that's, for me, as an innovation, explorer.
Mm.
I think it's important that we continue as we're right now, in June of 2021, over a year into this global pandemic, people are still using the word back more than they are using other words.
Yeah.
I just wonder when that's going to flip, when people are going to realize, it's been, 15, 16 months of this, there is no back.
Yeah.
Just park that word. We're not going back.
Mm-hmm.
And normal is the other word that still keeps a lot of real estate in people's minds. And I noticed you did not use that phrase either. You talked about where we're headed moving forward.
Yeah.
What the world will look like in the future.
Mm-hmm.
and attach no judgment to it and attach no kind of relevance, no connection to the previous world because they're gone. So I really, really love the way you frame that up.
That's a learned behavior, Jared. I'm a Scottish Presbyterian by background, which means that if something good happens, something bad happens.
Okay.
But I've put a mantra into my head, which is I don't do history. And therefore history is, you know, if you go to Taleb and his work on anti-fragile, all the scientists in the world can look back and try and give us all the evidence to say what the future is going to be. But actually, you can't predict the future. So you can make yourself anti-fragile. Mm-hmm. You can make yourself, and even the Center for Resilience redefined their definition of resilience to be the ability to thrive in chaos, basically.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
And therefore, if you think about that, that's the beauty of innovation. You know, there's that scene in Monty Python where the two poor people are down in the mud and they're getting nuggets out and the king's riding past. The quote is, so, oh, there goes a king. He says, why is he a king? Because he's not covered in dirt.
Yeah.
The spirit of the dirt and getting down and leaving your ego and expertise at the door and playing and getting in there and leaving history and finding nuggets in what we're going through, which can help us in the future, is innovation. Yeah, that's the pure sense of it. So let's focus on the future. But I think for all those people who are suffering from mental health issues, there's a lot of work that we need to do. I meditate every day. I'm doing a course called Positive Intelligence, which is amazing. To ensure that my judge and my saboteurs don't get in the way of me being positive to the future.
Yeah, that's such an important statement. Thank you for saying that. Before we shift gears a bit, I want to come back to the comment about leaders taking the ship out of the harbor. You alluded to it briefly there. It caught my ear. I wondered if you'd talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I do a lot of work with leaders in a lot of organizations. And my experience is a lot of leaders and organizations just sail their ship around the harbor. So they're playing at leadership. They're playing at sailing. They wrap it up as management. They do their performance management. They wait till they've the end of year to give feedback to their team. You know, they wait to get their goals passed down. They wait till the competitors give them their goals by saying, we're doing this, so they go. And therefore, for me, the analogy goes about, and it part of it was inspired by when I was thinking about this, but also my experience is the hero's journey.
Yes.
So thinking Lord of the Rings, big fan, Frodo and Sam leaving the village, they gather their group together, they have a guide, Gandalf, and they go off and they do things. But The ship and getting out, the hero's journey, means that they need to go into the rougher seas to stretch themselves. That's where they will get the real learning. And this great book that we were just briefly talking before we came on about peak performance, Stress and Rest. Stress and rest equals growth. So I was inspired when I was putting this together by the story of Chatham, where it's the film with Chris Pine, where he rescues a crew from a boat on past the Outer Banks over Cape Cod.
All right.
And I was the analogy of going out past the Outer Banks and the leader going into the seas, the rougher seas, and losing his compass, all the things, the analogies in there, losing the compass, being told not to. And those things about, you know, almost breaking the rules, stretching the boundaries, is the analogy I would have for leaders. Before you're disrupted, classic phrase, before you're disrupted, disrupt yourself.
Right.
But as a leader, our definition of it is agitating for the future. So you're not doing your role as a leader if you are not agitating for the future. And the only way you're going to agitate is a degree of stress, not too much,
right,
but a degree of stress. Then there's a degree of rest, which is going to that point of reflection. And, you know, the Ozan Varel, who wrote Think Like a Rocket Scientist, he would say, I hate fail, fail fast as a mantra. And there's a bit in there, because unless you're failing and reflection is the key bit, and then learning, then you're not growing. So sail your ship into the rougher seas. And I add a bit of ad lib onto that and say, you know, come back with barnacles on your butt. Yeah. Because unless you feel you've got barnacles on your butt, you haven't done it. Unless you've felt that tension.
Yep.
And, you know, as a cyclist, unless I've cycled that bit further, unless I've looked at my system, my core, how I cycle, unless I've worked and tinkered on my nutrition before I go out there, a leader tinkering with their systems to improve their performance of the team then unless they're doing that, I don't think they've got the license to lead. I think they're playing at it, mm-hmm. and they're wasting a lot of people's time who work for them. Mm-hmm. They're either getting in their way or they're not releasing their full potential. So that's a strong statement, but that's my belief. Yeah.
It's refreshingly direct.
Yes.
I like it. I like it a lot. That's important. It's important because it doesn't get much play. It's not fun to hear. And so people don't say it much. Mm. Anytime someone can make a statement like that, it's important to sort of start to try to balance the equation. Mm. And so I think that's brilliant and super important. Mm. I wanted to ask about cycling. Mm. Most of the people who do innovation work, who do this, you know, entrepreneurs, all those types of folks, they have a hobby. Mine is, you know, I play jazz piano and sing.
Oh, I like your hobby better than mine.
I think yours will make you live longer. But I love the intricacies of learning the theory and executing it and the improvisational aspects of once you learn the theory, applying it to express yourself and things like that. Mm. What does cycling give you?
It's fascinating because I started as a triathlete and that was where my real insights came because I, you know, I'm not a small bloke. Wow. And therefore I'm pounding the pavements, I'm pounding the roads.
It's a lot of punishment.
Yeah, it's a lot of punishment in your system. Yeah. And so therefore I started thinking about three disciplines. I need to be a good swimmer. I need to be a good cyclist. I need to be a good runner. And then I need to think that I'm going to do a half Ironman, which was my goal. My original was an Ironman, but I realized I'm not. But a half Ironman. So I did, you know, my first half Ironman. And I realized I had to be resilient, survive. But I also had to subdue my ego because my competitive side, my ego was getting in the way to think, well, I can't do it. You know, my first one was 8 hours, you know, but it was a tough one, uphills and everything else. Listen to the victim coming in. You know, it was in the Lake District, it's Cold Lake, and Lake District is a mountainous region in the UK.
Wow.
However, I had to realize that all I was doing was ensuring that all my systems were in play. And I started to play with different systems. I started to play with diet. I started to give up dairy. So I was tinkering with that. So that gave me this concept of fit to lead. Tinkering with the diets. Then I started to do meditation because there's a lady who cycled with me who was just brilliant. Because I used to go, oh, there's a hill coming up. You know, there's a hill. And she would go, nah, you got to love the hill. So as she got the hill, she sped up and she just went, love it. There's a hill. She said, I've taught myself to go, I love hills. Wow. So now when I'm heading towards a hill, might not look it, but I'm saying in my head, I love hills. I love hills. So that mindset piece came in. So actually, as you built on all the diet, the mindset, the fitness, the core strengths, when you realize your gut, your head are two things that impact massively in your life. Mm. And then you put a sport and a stress and a pressure and recovery and sleep and all of these things, then put that into leadership and think about the systems that a leader has accountability for and how subtle variations in those systems, either deficits or additions, they have a bad day and they walk in grumpy as hell, they bite the head off somebody, how that impacts the system psychological. And I started to think that. So a bit like I love the concept of jazz because I love improv, but that ability, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. When you're in there and you're all prepared for your spontaneity session, the thing that will keep you going is your core strength, your mindset, your fit to lead pieces. So if you combine jazz with cycling, you sort of got two analogies you could add in to say, those are probably two core skills for leaders, being able to tap dance and improv, but having the anti-fragility of all the systems being in the right order to be able to adapt when they're facing whatever they're facing.
Exactly. Well said. I love the loving the hills. Mm. For me, the piano equivalent would be loving the hand and piano exercises that are extremely, extremely boring.
Yeah.
But if you ever want to be interesting on a, you know, you have to be boring.
Yeah.
So I thank you for that. I always get so much out of how people like you approach your hobbies. Mm. And thank you for sharing that.
No, I've already got whiplash in my mind from your jazz thing. If it's in the movie Whiplash, and I'm just wondering if you're going through that and the bleeding hands and everything.
Oh, my goodness. I haven't been able to look at J.K. Simmons the same way since that movie.
Exactly.
He's one of my favorite actors.
He's brilliant.
He did an amazing job.
Yeah.
So any advice for future innovators out there?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I have one of our advisory board is Andrew Webster. So if I had somebody to come on and talk about innovation, be my mentor and my guide, and he's very humble. He's a humble Canadian guy who would always say, well, you've given me more than I've given you. And we have this conversation going, no, you've given more than I've given you. But he just has this ability in his mind to think about innovation as transformation.
Oh.
It's interesting because I know that a previous guest in yours, her show was Heather, and she works with the same tools. And this combination of innovation and change, is a massive way. And Andrew would talk about this as transformation. And if you think about transformation, then for me, innovation is great, but does it land in a system and whether it succeeds in a system?
Mm-hmm.
Tim Brown was at a talk, and I got to ask him a question. I said, we go and teach all these people innovation, design thinking. And then they get back to work and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I said, so what would be the advice for organizations? And he said, to treat your organization like a series of projects. So if you think about project work, how we do that. So my big bit of advice is two things. Think about it in transformation, but think about it in projects. And we've actually changed our mantra in our business. Rather than strategic goals, we've got strategic projects.
Uh-huh.
So what are the systems that will allow us to be successful with strategic projects? But the projects almost give people almost a finite, this is the beginning and the end, it's going to be delivered. And then we're on to the next project, the next project, the next project. And therefore, I can sprint through this. I can do a sprint here. I can do paint by numbers over here. So two things. One is transformation. And the second thing is think in projects. Even whether it's your career, your hobby, just think project, structure it, break it down in that concept. And I think that's the future for me, as I think you go back to the hybrid world. And you think about the project structure and how you might get people working at home and in work. There's going to be touch points where they need to come together. Then there's project work that go off separately to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to have collaboration tools, but the project focus for innovation and to get innovation to succeed in organizations is the other bit I would add in there. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you for that advice. I'm going to apply that myself. So I was selfishly file that away. The time just flew by. Thank you so much, Colin, for joining us today. It was a genuine pleasure. I really appreciate you making the time.
Jared, it was a real pleasure to be here. And thank you. I'm going to go off to watch Whiplash. And I'm going to be thinking about you doing, what was the term you said in the jazz? Yeah, what was the term?
Playing Hannons. Yeah,
Hannons,
I'll send you a link to that book so you can see how boring those things are.
I'll look forward to that. Lovely to talk to you, Jared, today.
All right. Take care.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this week's show. You can drop us a line on Twitter at Outlast LLC, OutlastLLC, or follow us on LinkedIn where we're Outlast Consulting. Until next time, keep innovating, whatever that means.